This is Gene with the BBC World News for Thursday, May 28, 2026. Iran says it targeted American base after fresh U.S. strikes. Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, or IRGC, has said it targeted an American airbase in the region after fresh U.S. strikes on southern Iran overnight. Kuwait, which hosts a U.S. base, said it had intercepted hostile missile and drone threats, but did not confirm the target. The Iranian missile launch came after the U.S. shot down Iranian drones over the Strait of Hormuz and struck a military site in Bandar Abbas, a strategic port city in southern Iran. It is the second time in 3 days that the U.S. has attacked targets in Iran, saying they were conducted in self-defense. The renewed hostilities threaten a fragile ceasefire between Washington and Tehran. The IRGC said the attack on the U.S. airbase took place in the early hours of Thursday morning and targeted the source of earlier U.S. strikes on Iran, according to state broadcaster IRIB. U.S. Central Command, or CENTCOM, said Iran's attack on Kuwait was an egregious ceasefire violation that occurred hours after Iranian forces launched 5 one-way attack drones that posed a clear threat in and near the Strait of Hormuz. It said all the drones were intercepted and that a 6th drone launched from an Iranian ground control site in Bandar Abbas was also prevented. CENTCOM described its actions as measured, purely defensive, and intended to maintain the ceasefire. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Esmail Bakai, meanwhile, condemned the U.S. strikes and said they constituted a violation of the ceasefire. He added that the Islamic Republic would, quote, take all necessary measures to defend its national sovereignty, according to quotes cited by IRIB. Kuwait's foreign affairs ministry strongly condemned what it termed criminal Iranian attacks that targeted its territory. Earlier this week, the U.S. confirmed a previous round of self-defense strikes on southern Iran on Monday, in which they targeted Iranian missile sites and boats attempting to lay mines in the strait, where thousands of commercial tanker ships are stranded as a result of the conflict. CENTCOM said those strikes were designed to protect our troops from threats posed by Iranian forces. The U.S. also imposed sanctions on the Persian Gulf Strait Authority, the Iranian body tasked with collecting payments from ships traveling through the Strait of Hormuz. Any ships that pay the authority could also be exposed to the risk of sanctions, the U.S. Treasury Department said in a statement. 1/5 of the world's liquefied natural gas and oil normally pass through the shipping channel, and its closure has impacted global fuel trade. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Bakai said on Monday that Tehran was collecting fees for navigational services, and it would continue to manage traffic through the waterway. U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent described it as the Iranian military's latest attempt to extort global maritime trade and proof that Iran is desperate for cash. The IRGC also said on Tuesday that it had downed a U.S. drone and fired at a fighter jet and another drone that entered Iranian airspace, but did not specify when. Protracted negotiations have been taking place to end the three-month war that has choked traffic in the Strait of Hormuz and caused global energy prices to shoot up. During a cabinet meeting on Wednesday, U.S. President Donald Trump said that Iran is negotiating on fumes, insisting that his war strategy will not be impacted by November's U.S. midterm elections. Maybe we have to go back and finish it. Maybe we don't, he said. During that meeting, the president also urged Gulf nations to sign on to the Abraham Accords to normalize relations with Israel. Israel launched the war against Iran alongside the U.S. on February 28, and is also embroiled in a war with Iranian-backed Hezbollah in Lebanon. Trump has threatened to resume a large-scale bombing campaign if Iran does not agree to his terms. While Trump struck an optimistic note over the weekend, saying that a peace deal with Iran had been, quote, largely negotiated, by Wednesday's cabinet meeting, he said that the U.S. was not satisfied. He said Tehran was very much intent on reaching an agreement to end the conflict, but added, so far they haven't gotten there, repeating Washington's willingness to resume strikes if one is not reached. His remarks came after Iranian state TV reported what it said were details of a draft agreement, which included reopening the Strait of Hormuz and the withdrawal of U.S. forces from the region. The White House branded the text a, quote, complete fabrication. Both sides signaled progress had been made towards a deal late last week, prompting speculation that an announcement was close. However, Tehran soon cautioned a deal was, quote, not imminent, while Trump said he had instructed his negotiators not to rush into one. Israel hits Lebanese capital in targeted strike. Israel has hit the Lebanese capital, Beirut, for only the second time since the start of a ceasefire last month. The Israeli Defense Forces, that is IDF, said the attack at about 1400 hours was carried out in a targeted manner, but gave no details. Israeli media cited unnamed sources as saying the target of the strike had been the head of an Iranian militia. Israel had spared Beirut at the request of U.S. President Donald Trump, and the attack came after waves of Israeli strikes aimed at Hezbollah infrastructure in southern Lebanon, according to the IDF. Both Israel and Hezbollah, the powerful Shia group supported by Iran, have accused each other of repeated violations of a ceasefire. Thick smoke was seen billowing across residential buildings in Dahiya, the densely populated Shia suburb that serves as Hezbollah's stronghold in the capital after the latest Israeli attack. Residents could be heard calling out to neighbors and relatives to check on their safety as rescue crews rushed in. According to Israeli media, the target of the strike was Ali al-Husni, head of the missile force in the Imam Hussein Division, an Iranian militia allied to Hezbollah. The strikes came after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced an expansion of a ground operation following Hezbollah drone attacks on troops occupying part of southern Lebanon and on civilians in northern Israel. On Wednesday, the IDF urged residents to move north of the Zahrani River, about 25 miles from the Israeli border, saying it would act with extreme force. At least 11 people were killed in two sets of Israeli strikes, which hit Tyre and an area to the city's east early on Thursday, according to the Lebanese Health Ministry. Social media videos from Tyre, one of Lebanon's biggest cities, showed streets lit orange by flames, smoke-filled roads, and at least one vehicle engulfed in fire. By daylight, a massive fireball was filmed erupting near a cluster of high-rise residential buildings, sending a mushroom-shaped column of smoke rising above the city skyline. Stunned residents looked on as debris spread through surrounding streets. A Hezbollah member in Tyre told the BBC rescue and recovery crews had been forced to stop their work because conditions remain too dangerous, and workers received calls from the Israeli military warning them to evacuate the area. Wednesday's evacuation order was the largest since the ceasefire took effect, covering about 300 towns and villages, about 14% of Lebanese territory. Many residents, including those already displaced from other parts of southern Lebanon, have nowhere obvious to go. The streets of Saida were oddly busy on Thursday. The marina area filled with beachgoers eating lunch, and not a tent for the displaced in sight. But with shelters exceeding capacity, humanitarian workers and city officials told those displaced to keep going north. There is no more room here. Saida is a coastal city north of the Zahrani River, but south of Beirut. It has not been hit as hard as other cities like Tyre or Nabatea. It was not named in the latest set of evacuation orders, so Hanan Jama, 46, was shocked when she was woken up in the middle of the night to hear an apartment she owned had been hit. She had been renting it out as a source of income. A missile struck the building at approximately 2:40, appearing to hit the roof before tearing downward through the structure. Four people were killed in the building, two displaced people, and two residents from Saida. The man renting the apartment from Hana had been living there for 3 years. She said he was a civilian. "We aren't with Hezbollah, and we aren't with Israel," she said through tears. "We just want peace." Israeli officials have said Hezbollah's attacks are violating the temporary ceasefire deal between the Israeli and Lebanese governments, which has been extended twice since it came into force last month. Lebanese officials have pointed to the Israeli strikes themselves as violations. The escalation threatens to derail talks aimed at ending the war between the U.S. and Israel on one side and Iran on the other. Iran insists that any deal must also cover Lebanon. Israel says it reserves the right to continue to fight the threat from Hezbollah. Lebanon was drawn into the war on March 2nd, when Hezbollah launched rockets into Israel in retaliation for an Israeli strike that killed Iran's supreme leader. Israel responded with an air campaign across Lebanon and a ground invasion. At least 3,224 people have been killed in Lebanon since the start of the war, according to the country's health ministry. Its figures do not distinguish between combatants and civilians. Israel says 23 of its soldiers and 4 Israeli civilians have been killed over the same period on both sides of the border. Man arrested after 3 injured in stabbing at Swiss train station. A man has been arrested after 3 people were injured in a stabbing attack at a train station in Switzerland, police said. They said the three victims, Swiss nationals aged 28, 43, and 52, were hospitalized after the attack at Winterthur train station. The suspect, a 31-year-old Swiss man, used a bladed weapon, and that the motive was under investigation, police added. An eyewitness working in an office building nearby told a local newspaper he heard a man yell, "Allahu Akbar," meaning "God is greatest" in Arabic, at around 8:30 local time before attacking people with a knife. A group of schoolchildren were passing through the area at a time, and a school teacher was seen standing in front of them to protect them, according to local media. Another eyewitness, a taxi driver, told Zurich-based daily Neuer Zürcher Zeitung that a man had been walking around the station's underpass, attacking people. Photos published by Swiss news outlets show several areas around the station being cordoned off. U.S. Justice Department launches criminal investigation into Trump accuser E. Jean Carroll. The U.S. Department of Justice has opened a criminal investigation into writer E. Jean Carroll, who accused President Donald Trump of sexual assault. CBS News, the BBC's U.S. partner, has reported. The investigation is looking into whether Carroll committed perjury in connection with civil cases she brought against Trump, the news outlet quotes sources as saying. Carroll, a former magazine columnist, accused Trump of sexual assault and defamation and successfully sued him in two cases. Both judgments were upheld on appeal, but Trump has since asked the Supreme Court to overturn the first of them. He has denied the accusations. The BBC has contacted Carroll's lawyer for comment. The GOJ declined to comment. In 2023, a jury found Trump liable for sexual assault. He was also found liable for defamation for comments he made the previous year in a post on Truth Social. In that post, he denied Carroll's claim that she had been attacked by him in the mid-1990s in the New York department store dressing room. A second lawsuit in 2024 found Trump again liable for defamation in connection with comments he made about Carroll in 2019, in which he accused her of making up the claims against him to sell a book. Trump has appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn the first judgment, for which he was ordered to pay $5 million to Carroll. He has also vowed to do the same with the other case, in which Carroll was awarded $83 million. The new criminal case is looking into whether Carroll lied when she said in a 2022 deposition that she received no outside funding for her civil lawsuit against Trump, a source told CBS. It was revealed in legal papers first filed by Trump's lawyers in 2023 that the co-founder of LinkedIn, Reid Hoffman, had helped to pay for some of Carroll's legal fees and expenses. The issue was brought up during the case's appeal, and the court found that Carroll had plausibly represented in her deposition that she had forgotten about the limited outside funding counsel obtained. The additional discovery showed that Ms. Carroll simply was not involved in the matter of who was or was not funding her litigation costs. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second District continued in a 2024 ruling. The new investigation is being led by the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Northern District of Illinois, one source told CBS. CNN, which first reported the story, reported that while Carroll's deposition took place in New York, one of the individuals who helped cover some of Carroll's legal fees, Hoffman, has a non-profit organization based in Chicago. The BBC has also approached Hoffman's non-profit for comment. Acting U.S. Attorney General Todd Blanche, who personally represented Trump in the appeal cases against Carroll, is recused from the case, a source told CBS. Since returning to office last year, Trump has repeatedly called on the DOJ to prosecute a range of his adversaries. The DOJ also recently created a $1.8 billion fund to pay individuals deemed to have been unfairly investigated during the tenure of previous presidents. But some members of Trump's own Republican Party have joined opposition Democrats in condemning the plan. One of the chief concerns raised by critics is about potential compensation for individuals who assaulted Capitol police officers on January 6. How My Brother Went from Liberal Hollywood Actor to Manosphere Messiah. 10 years ago, Luis Castilleja was a freewheeling creative seeking his fortune as an actor in Hollywood and enjoying the liberal Los Angeles lifestyle. Now he is better known as El Tamach, Latin America's biggest manosphere influencer, whose misogynistic and hyper-masculine content has gained him more than 11 million social media followers. His sister Alex says his transformation is shocking, and they no longer speak. I don't like saying El Tamach because, for me, he's a completely different person. So I'm sister with the human that he was, she says. Alex, a design engineer from Mexico, says her brother's metamorphosis shows how even the most unlikely people can be tempted into making manosphere content once they realize the money and fame to be made. The impact of Western influences such as Andrew Tate has been well documented, but a BBC World Service investigation has scrutinized the content and followings of 15 other influencers based in South and East Asia, Latin America, and Africa, and found that on average their followings have tripled in the past 3 years. These regions have seen relatively recent gains in gender equality, and experts say this environment is fueling men's hunger for manosphere content. As well as El Tamach, our investigation also focused on Andrew Kibbe, a household name in Kenya, who promotes male self-empowerment and misogyny on social media. Both have repeatedly attacked single mothers and regularly accuse women of being gold diggers who manipulate men. Both influencers, we found, are earning large sums of money from their platforms. El Tamach and Kibbe both strongly deny their content is misogynistic, with Kibbe, in an interview with the BBC, even disputing the existence of a concept. We wanted to see the impact this content has on consumers. Two Gen Z followers, one in Kenya and one in Mexico, gave the BBC uncensored access to several years of their social media activity, allowing us to see thousands of their posts, views, likes, comments, and shares. The data reveals their personal journeys into the manosphere. Mexican Julian first started using Instagram aged 16, liking and commenting on content about cars, fitness, and self-development. His history shows that he liked first a video from El Tamach a few months later, and after it appeared in his recommendation feeds. Now 19, he has so far liked more than 3,000 videos from dozens of manosphere creators. Julian told the BBC he felt feminism has made men's problems invisible. That sentiment is a key tenet of El Tamacha's messaging, but he did not always hold these views, according to his sister Alex. He grew up wanting to be a performer, she says, and after studying theater in Mexico City, moved to L.A. to pursue his dream of becoming an actor. But he returned home a couple of years later, she says, after a breakup and failure to book regular work. These setbacks motivated him to help other young men navigate difficult experiences, she says, and he began in 2020 to post content focused on male self-development. I think at the beginning it was very noble how he wanted to help other men to feel worthy and valuable, and that's how he started, Alex says. But this quickly twisted into something else. He got this messiah complex, like he's the one that has to fix men's issues, she tells us. And she says he soon began to blame women for the difficulties his male followers were navigating. She's not sure how far her brother actually believes the misogyny he exposes, and how much is just for social media likes and views. He believes some things, and others he's just experimenting what works best with the algorithm. Her brother admitted he was simply copying Andrew Tate, says Alex. Tate was super big at that time, and since he saw it worked, he just started pushing this argument further and further. She says her brother's content soon became mirrored in his behavior towards her. Anything I would express was taken like a feminist belief, an affront to his persona. The BBC asked El Tamach to take part in our documentary. He initially agreed to speak to us, inviting us to film his world tour, which began in the U.S. But just days before we were due to fly out, he went live on YouTube, telling his followers he had no intention of participating. BBC and Miss Jackie from the BBC, we don't need your permission to be men. Make your documentary. Don't involve me or my bros. We nevertheless went to his show in Las Vegas, which was a mixture of self-improvement advice and sexist rhetoric, including advising his fans to avoid sluts because they will never change, and that single mothers are not a good catch because their status reflects poor life decisions and character flaws. Afterwards, we tried to confront him about these statements, but his security blocked our way. El Tamacha's earnings from content, including these shows, is sizable. According to our analysis, from April 25 to 26, El Tamacha made an estimated $1.5 million from social media views alone. He also made $200,000 to $300,000 from YouTube Super Chats, in which fans pay to boost the prominence of their comments during live streams, often asking for relationship advice, as well as $800 per person for small group workshops. This is in addition to the money he made from merchandise and his regular stage shows. His team told us they consider it highly irresponsible to publish the estimated income of El Tamacha. Kibbe also monetizes his popularity, selling merchandise and even a crypto coin. He told the BBC, if anybody is really my fan, the only thing I tell them is to make sure you send me money via a Kenyan app. One group of men we spoke to outside El Tamacha's Las Vegas show told us what they liked about his content, that he encourages discipline, inspires them to find self-confidence, and acknowledges their problems. He focuses a lot on men as having been dismissed by society, and the narrative that women have, you know, been the stars of the show, says Dr. Ali Siles, gender and masculinities researcher at the National Autonomous University of Mexico. He has this message of, you do matter, believe in yourself. And this is what fan Julian says he likes about the influencer too. The teaching that impacted me the most was about feeling confident. Kenyan University student Ryan, who follows the videos of Andrew Kibbe, says as a young man raised by a single mother, he views the influence as a surrogate father figure. Using analytical tools developed by the University of Queensland, we found Ryan had watched videos on TikTok from Kibbe, whose hashtag has attracted more than 500 million views, after searching for terms such as success, self-improvement, and masculinity tips with no father. But Siles says Manosphere content tends to come at the expense of women and other gender identities. It's very harmful to women's rights and development because it's also trying to put them back in places a lot of them have been trying to get out of, with limited choices, with very stereotypical roles. Julian's social media history shows how such messaging, in his case from El Tamach, soon becomes mirrored by followers. When Julian broke up with a girlfriend in late 2023, his interactions with Manosphere content spiked, and he began referring to women as sluts in his online comments and praising subservience. Quote, if you're a feminist and submissive woman, then perfect, he wrote in one post. Julian says he regrets the tone of his past Instagram comments, but stands by their content. Many of Julian's generation believe that feminism has come at the cost of men's rights, according to a recent global survey of 23,000 men and women by King's College London. More than half of Gen Z men, some 57%, agreed with the statement, quote, we have gone so far in promoting women's equality that we are discriminating against men, end quote. It's a belief that Manosphere influencers are tapping into. According to these influencers, women are the problem, says Awino Okech at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. Their belief, says the professor of feminist and security studies, is it's this gender equality thing that is leading to boys underperforming. It's gender equality that is leading to mental problems for men and boys. These misleading narratives can have a real-world impact, we found. Fernanda, a doctor from Mexico City, says her ex-partner, also a doctor, used El Tamach's messaging to justify his controlling behavior. On what was to become the day they split up, she says he locked her in a room and forced her to watch videos made by El Tamach for 4 hours. He kept saying, see, I'm not doing anything wrong. You're the one who's wrong. She told us the situation that day escalated to the point where he threatened to kill her. His eyes were empty. He was acting purely on impulse. In that moment, I was really very afraid of what might happen to me. Though she does not blame El Tamach directly for her experience, Fernanda does believe this type of content has an effect on relationships in the real world. I think my former partner was already a sexist who was hiding it, but El Tamach has influenced him to no longer feel bad about it. Alex, El Tamach's sister, thinks her brother is in denial about the negative impact of his content. I think he knows what he's doing on some level. I think that he sees and realizes that if he ever owns up to what he did, it'll destroy him. She feels he has drifted from the path he was destined to follow into this weird dystopic hell and he's just this violence robot. It's very sad. The BBC asked El Tomash to respond to our allegations that he promotes misogynistic content. His team responded to say they categorically rejected the allegations and that they were unfounded and taken out of context. Kibbe, when challenged on his misogynistic content, denied this term applied to him and said, "No man hates a woman. We love you. We are like gods to you. Worship us." Ex-U.S. government official arrested after $40 million in gold bars found in home. A former U.S. government official has been arrested after FBI investigators found hundreds of gold bars worth more than $40 million in his Virginia home. David Rush made several requests to the U.S. government to receive the bars for work-related expenses over the past year, according to court documents. He has been charged with criminal theft of public money in a complaint filed last week. According to the New York Times, Rush held a senior position in the CIA until recently. He was arrested and is being held in detention until his hearing this week. His attorney declined to comment. Agents also uncovered about $2 million in U.S. currency in Rush's home, along with 35 luxury watches, many of them Rolexes. Rush, who court documents say had top-secret clearance and access to classified information, has also been accused of lying about his education and military service when applying for his government job, and fraudulently taking military leave with thousands of dollars in pay. Rush is a former senior executive in a U.S. government agency in Virginia, court documents state. Asked about Rush's case, the FBI said in a written statement that it arrested an individual on May 19 following a referral from the CIA. After a CIA internal investigation identified potential violations of the law, CIA Director John Ratcliffe referred the information to the FBI for a law enforcement investigation, the FBI said. Between November 2025 and March 2026, Rush made several requests to the U.S. government to obtain a significant quantity of foreign currency and tens of millions of dollars in gold bars for work-related expenses, which he later received, court documents state. During a review, the CIA was unable to locate the gold bars or significant amounts of the foreign currency, court documents state. The government was also unable to locate any record of Rush providing information to his employer regarding the disposition of the currency or gold bars that he received for work-related purposes. The FBI then executed a search warrant for Rush's home in Virginia on May 18. During the search, FBI agents seized approximately 303 gold bars, each of which weighs approximately 1 kilogram, the agency said in court documents. Based on the current price of gold, the estimated value exceeds $40 million, they added. The court documents do not indicate why Rush kept the gold bars and currency in his home. The BBC has contacted the CIA for comment. Google worker charged with using internal data to make $1.2 million on bets. A Google employee has been arrested for allegedly using its access to company information to successfully place lucrative bets on the prediction platform Polymarket. The U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York said it had charged Michele Spagnuolo, a Google engineer, with breaking insider trading laws because of several bets he placed through the platform. Although Spagnuolo is an Italian citizen who lives in Switzerland, he was arrested on Wednesday and brought before a federal judge in New York. Spagnuolo allegedly used information he had early access to through his work at Google, which is based in the U.S., to make bets that saw him rack up $1.2 million in winnings. A spokeswoman for Google said the company was working with law enforcement on their investigation, and that the employee had been placed on leave. The internal information that was allegedly used was marketing material accessed using a tool available to all employees, but using such confidential information to place bets is a serious breach of our policies, she added. A spokesman for Polymarket said the platform worked closely with authorities on the investigation. Blockchain trading is transparent, traceable, and bad actors leave footprints, the spokesman added. Blockchain is a sort of digital record applying to cryptocurrency, which is the only currency Polymarket accepts. The U.S. Attorney's Office worked with the Federal Bureau of Investigation on Spagnuolo's arrest. He has been released on a $2.25 million bond, according to ABC News. Although Spagnuolo allegedly traded under the account name Alpha Raccoon on Polymarket, and his bets were made with cryptocurrency from several accounts, the FBI said it linked his accounts by finding one he had opened with an Italian identification card. Spagnuolo did not respond to an email seeking comment. According to online profiles, he worked for Google for more than 12 years as an engineer focused on information security. He started using Polymarket in 2024, and between October and December of last year, the U.S. Attorney's Office said Spagnuolo placed $2.7 million in bets related to Google. By using internal information, he was able to make more than $1 million in profits from those bets, it said. The court papers said Spagnuolo's most lucrative alleged Polymarket wins were correctly predicting who would and would not be the most searched for person on Google in 2025. It allegedly placed bets against names like Bianca Censori and President Donald Trump, and chose the singer D4VD as taking the top spot when the bidding platform had odds of that result being near zero. The court papers said that when Spagnuolo placed that bet in November, he knew that D4VD had become Google's most searched person because he had access to information the search giant had collected before it was released to the public. D4VD, a musician, is currently in jail for allegedly murdering a teenage girl. Jill Biden says she thought husband was having a stroke during 2024 debate. Former U.S. First Lady Jill Biden says she thought her husband, President Joe Biden, was having a stroke during his infamously faltering presidential debate in 2024. I was frightened because I had never seen Joe like that before or since. Never, Jill Biden told CBS News, the BBC's U.S. partner. I don't know what happened, she said. As I watched it, I thought, oh my God, he's having a stroke, and it scared me to death. President Biden faced intense pressure from fellow Democrats to step down as their candidate after a poor debate performance, against then-Republican candidate Donald Trump. Biden ultimately dropped out of the race and endorsed then-Vice President Kamala Harris. The former First Lady's interview with CBS News Sunday Morning's Rita Braver will air on Sunday. Jill Biden has stood beside her husband throughout his decades-long career, from his time as a Delaware senator to his years as president. She was considered to be one of the most influential advisors during his presidency, and among those who ultimately encouraged him to drop out of the 2024 race. Following the June 2024 debate, months ahead of the presidential election, Democrats expressed unease at the president's shaky debate performance. Biden's campaign at the time insisted the president would not step down as the Democratic candidate and that he would debate Donald Trump again. During the debate, in which both men sought a second term, Biden and Trump sparred on major topics, including immigration, the economy, and abortion rights. Biden had a raspy voice, which his team said was because he was ill, and a moment where he seemed to lose his train of thought. At a post-debate rally in Atlanta, Jill Biden introduced her husband on stage and praised his performance against Trump. "Joe, you did such a great job. You answered every question. You knew all the facts," she told the crowd. But elsewhere, Democratic leaders and donors expressed concerns about the then-president's performance. Kamala Harris, who rarely criticized Biden publicly, even admitted it was a slow start to the debate. Voters' concerns about Biden's health, mental acuity, and age, 81 at the time, already weighed heavily on the debate. Biden's showing at the debate became a key topic of scrutiny in U.S. media outlets, with concerns raised about his ability to do the job of president, as well as his chances in the November 2024 election. It was thought unlikely that Biden, the incumbent president, would be replaced as the Democratic Party's nominee just a few months before the election. The difficult process of choosing another nominee was seen as having the potential to derail the party's White House bid. But his debate performance, along with gaffes during a NATO summit in the following weeks and a frail demeanor after a COVID diagnosis, ultimately led him to ending his candidacy. Harris assumed the Democratic nomination about 3 months before the election and ultimately lost her bid to Trump. In the aftermath of her election loss, Harris criticized her former boss, calling Biden's decision to seek a second term recklessness. "It's Joe and Jill's decision. We all said that like a mantra, as if we'd all been hypnotized," Harris wrote in her memoir. "Was it grace or was it recklessness? In retrospect, I think it was recklessness." "16 pupils killed in Kenya school fire. 16 students have been killed in a fire at a boarding school in Gilgil, about 77 miles northwest of the Kenyan capital, Nairobi," the authorities have confirmed. Dozens of other students were injured and taken to hospital. 71 were later discharged, and 7 admitted for further treatment. Education Minister Julius Ogamba said while visiting the scene of the blaze. He said the cause of the fire had not yet been established and investigations were ongoing. The fire that is at the Utumishi Girls Academy started in the early hours of Thursday as the students were asleep. Anxious parents and relatives have been gathering at the scene, waiting for news of their loved ones. The education minister said the fire broke out on the first floor of one of the dormitories, which was completely destroyed in the blaze. The response teams managed to put out the fire by about 300 hours, but by then the damage had already been done, he said. He added that the school would begin releasing students to their parents and guardians throughout the day as authorities continue investigations. Interior Minister Kipchumba Murkomen, who was also among the officials gathered at the school, sent his condolences to the bereaved families. It's a very anxious moment, and even as we account for the 16 so far identified as having passed on, I want to ask the people of Kenya that together we stand with the families in prayer and support. I ask everyone to be patient and avoid speculation, he said. Earlier, speaking to parents and crowds outside the school, Police Commander Masoud Mowinyi said it's a sad and distressing situation. Fires are not uncommon in Kenyan boarding schools, with several deadly incidents reported in recent years. Many have been the result of arson, with disgruntled pupils, angry about the discipline and living conditions, accused of being responsible, while others were caused by accident. Overcrowding in dormitories and the failure to follow safety guidelines, such as keeping exits clear and windows unlocked, have frequently been blamed for the high number of casualties. According to the police, the fire in Gilgil broke out around 1 local time and engulfed a dormitory block housing about 220 students. More than 800 children were in the school at the time of the tragedy. Earlier in the morning, Mowinyi said that some students who had fled into nearby areas during the chaos were still being traced. As we speak, our officers are combing the area because some students fled in shock and fear during the night, he said. Leah Sarem, whose daughter is a final-year student at the school, said the news of the fire came as a shock. She said she traveled alongside other parents to the school from the Rift Valley town of Nakuru, about 40 kilometers away. We were anxious because we didn't know whether our children were alive, she said, adding that there was a lot of sadness when they arrived at the compound. Sarem met her daughter several hours later. I was very happy and thanked God, she told reporters. She said that her daughter did not know how the fire started and had told her that students were waking each other up when the dormitory caught fire. We are praying for parents who have not yet met their children. We ask Kenyans to pray for us and remain calm as the cause of the fire is investigated, Sarem said. We've been here since 6. They're not telling us where our daughter is, one parent told the BBC in tears. She said her 17-year-old daughter was in her final year at the school. We have searched all hospitals around here. The teachers aren't telling us anything, the mother said. No one came to their rescue. Wambui Nediritu, whose cousin is a student at the school, said family members coming to the scene were met with confusion and fear. When we arrived at the school, we were told to queue. Most of us were so worried because we had heard some students had died and others were injured and in hospital. She said some students were injured after jumping from the upper floor of the dormitory while trying to escape. Some of those at the top floor had to jump out. That's why they were injured. Nediritu said her cousin survived the fire, but suffered a broken leg. I found her. She is fine, but she has a broken leg, she explained. Kenya has had a long history of school fires, with the deadliest being in 2001, when 67 students died in Machukuo County, southeast of the capital, after some students set fire to a dormitory. This has been Gene with the BBC World News for Thursday, May 28, 2026.
You may not be aware that there are many ways to listen to your favorite programs from the Talking Information Center. You may call us at 781-834-4400 to inquire about receiving a special TIC radio receiver. Or visit our website, ticnetwork.org, and click the Listen Now button on the homepage. Or listen through your phone by calling 425-585-1901. If you are a T-Mobile or Metro PCS customer, call 605-475-0129. Or listen on Amazon's Alexa. Simply say, Alexa, play radio station Talking Information Center. Or listen on Google Home or Google Home Mini. Simply say, Hey Google, play radio station Talking Information Center. Or you may listen by downloading our free app on your Apple or Android device. As you'll realize, there are many ways to access programming from the Talking Information Center these days. Choose the one that is right for you. If you would like any of this information repeated, please don't hesitate to call us at 781-834-4400 and we would be glad to assist you. Again, the number is 781-834-4400.